wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is 9:02, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host for today's show, I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. We call this show The Old Mole after Karl Marx's image of the revolution, that force of history brought about by the resistance and actions of ordinary people that suddenly erupts to change the relations of power in the world. Sooner or later, this system we call capitalism, that knows no rule except to expand and expand, will collapse under its own weight and from its exhaustion of our planet's resources, and we ordinary folks, if we can get our act together, will be ready to claim ownership of the world we have built and run it for the benefit of all. Today's show is about the struggles of ordinary people for a better world and who are working to overcome the forces that would serve and protect the existing order. Today's date, of course, is infamous in the U.S. because of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, but 9/11, el 11 de septiembre, had already achieved infamy because on that day in 1973, a U.S.-supported right-wing coup overthrew the elected socialist government of Salvador Allende in Chile. In a moment, old mole Lori Mercier will be talking with Marion Schlotterbeck, author of Beyond the Vanguard, Grassroots Movements in the Making of Revolutionary Chile, about the meaning of the coup and the resurgence of social movements in Chile today. And again today, of course, right here in Portland, we are contending with violence from the right in the form of neo-Nazis and the so-called alt-right. Bill Resnick will be talking with local activist Greg McKelvey about the best ways to respond to that violence in the streets. We'll conclude the show with a couple of shorter pieces. We'll hear from journalist Arun Gupta, who followed the Trump campaign, and I'll talk about why the owners of capital have less and less interest in the rest of us. You can hear this show or any part of it again by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can find further information about our guests and topics and links to other Old Mole shows. Today's show should be up in a day or two. First then, here is Lori Mercier to talk with Marion Schlotterbeck about the other 9/11. Lori.
Thanks, Clayton. Marion Schlotterbeck is an assistant professor of history at University of California, Davis, and a former researcher for the Chile Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, which is a great online resource featuring thousands of documents concerning often secret interventions of the United States in Latin America and the rest of the world. She is also the author of the forthcoming book, Beyond the Vanguard, Everyday Revolutionaries in Allende's Chile, and is here to talk about the legacies of the Movement of the Revolutionary Left, or MIR, MIR, both before and after the September 11, 1973 military coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. Welcome to KBOO, Marion Schlotterbeck.
Thank you.
Before we talk about the legacies and memories of MIR activism before and after the 73 military coup in Chile, tell us why Salvador Allende's and his Popular Unity's electoral victory in 1970 was such a seminal moment for other radical political projects across the hemisphere.
Salvador Allende promised a democratic, peaceful path to socialism. This was going to be a revolution through the ballot box of the Cold War. What Chile offered the world, and particularly the progressive radical imaginaries, was an alternative model, both to Soviet-style communism and to U.S. liberal capitalist democracy.
Marion?
Yes.
Okay, I think we're cut off there. Not such a great connection with your phone. So Allende's successes in land reform and nationalizing industries galvanized his right-wing opponents, including the Nixon administration in the United States. How did Pinochet's 1973 coup, which along with authoritarian rule, instituted neoliberal policies that dramatically ended Allende's reforms, also wipe out memories of the successes of the Popular Unity and MIR projects?
I think so often we say that the victors are the ones who get to write history, or they get to write the first version of it. And really, when the Chilean military junta came to power in 1973, they justified their actions as salvation for the country from the Marxist chaos that Allende had brought Chile to. With time, as the regime pivoted to implement neoliberal austerity measures, it started to become a kind of ends justify the means, that the economic benefits of the so-called Chilean miracle under Pinochet outweighed the human cost of political repression. And I think part of the reason why it became so hard to challenge that narrative is that so many of the neoliberal policies implemented under the dictatorship really remained in place after the 1990 democratic transition.
Hello, Marian.
Yes.
Okay. There were also assassination campaigns. I mean, deliberate efforts to eliminate the left in Chile as well. I mean, did that contribute to this wiping out of collective memories of the successes prior to the coup?
Absolutely. I mean, the scale of human rights violations under the Pinochet regime is astounding. Nearly 3,000 Chilean citizens were detained or disappeared and summarily executed by the regime. And I think one aspect of repression in Chile that is a little unique is that 40,000 Chileans, again, a much larger number than those who died at the hands of the military, actually survived the clandestine torture centers. And so really the scale of repression generated a widespread culture of fear that really inhibited being able to talk about what had come before 1973.
Now, what was the Plan Z that managed to also survive in collective memory?
Sure. Plan Z was a sort of propaganda fabrication that started to circulate in the month before the September 11th, 1973 coup. And Plan Z claimed that there was going to be the sort of auto coup on the left, that they published the names of several thousand non-Marxist Chileans who were supposedly going to be murdered in their beds at night, entire families, members of the business elites. And this sort of created a little bit of panic, but I think what was interesting was that at the time, everybody knew this was fake news. Nobody really believed it. As the dictatorship consolidated its hold on power through tremendous levels of repression, a lot of ordinary Chileans started to believe Plan Z. They needed a narrative that would make sense of the unimaginable brutality that was happening around them.
Well, since the end of the coup in 1990, what have been the ways in which people, and including yourself, have been trying to rescue the memories of the promises of mere activism and strategies of Allende's Popular Unity Project?
I think part of what we're seeing right now is a general kind of revisiting of the 1960s and revisiting of the leftist radical projects in the 1960s to try to understand what other legacies come out of these movements. The left sometimes is so good at telling only the narratives of its own defeat. Right? And so it's unquestionable that Allende's democratic project for socialism was defeated by the Chilean military with the backing of the U.S. government. But I wanted to know, what was it that really remained? What were the aspects of that experience that stayed with people? And I think through sort of what my book, Beyond the Vanguard, is looking at is the ways in which people are transformed by engaging in movement politics. These processes of grassroots empowerment and collective action and social struggle really endure in people's memories and remain a kind of touchstone that guides how they live their lives in spite of the defeat of the political project, in spite of everything that comes after.
So could you give us an example of that kind of transformation that took place and continues to survive?
Sure. I think a lot of what we see when we revisit the 1960s are examples of really successful coalitional grassroots movements, and those strategies for organizing still have a lot of relevance today. I think when we think about the 60s, we think everything was about class struggle and Marxism, but under the auspices of these leftist movements, we see a lot of the sort of seeds of the kind of horizontal participatory democratic practices that have come to define a lot of the new social movements and that we're seeing a resurgence of today, particularly starting around 2010, 2011, with Occupy Wall Street, with the Chilean student movement of 2011.
And what were the goals of that student movement of 2011?
Well, the movement happened in a particular moment in time. In 2010, Chileans elected Sebastián Piñera, a billionaire, outsider politician from the Conservative Party. This was the first time the right came back into power in Chile since the dictatorship had ended. He was a politician that was a lot more concerned with polling than with policy. And I think in a lot of ways, he's a figure who resonates with the sitting American president today. And so the fact that the right was back in power generated this opening for general social discontent that had been percolating for decades to manifest itself. And so we saw a series of different social movements, from LGBT rights to environmental rights. And then in June, college and high school students launched a movement to demand free, quality education. And in a moment of such sort of advanced state of capitalism, in a moment in which neoliberalism really seemed hegemonic, that demand for education as a right, not a consumer good, really seemed like a revolutionary act.
Yeah, and in addition to this kind of lasting legacy of that grassroots activism that Mir had practiced in the 1960s, what are the ways in which people have been reflecting about the lost opportunities to create a democratic revolution?
I mean, I think part of what is so clear in the tragedy of the 1973 coup in Chile is that it really marked sort of end of this period of progressive democratization of Chilean society, right? The Chilean political system broke down, and it broke down in this moment in which more and more people had a stake in it, in which more and more people were participating. And so in really fundamental ways, I think this question of the extent to which political party politics are democratized so that the base actually has a say and isn't always just following whatever the leaders the party puts forward wants, the ways in which there are real mechanisms for citizens to have their demands heard, to feel like their voices matter, not just every 4 years when they go to vote in elections.
And it's comforting to know that that kind of grassroots activism is alive and well in Chile today, despite that the decades of repression under the dictatorship. And thanks so much, Marian Schlatterbeck, for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour and remembering the significance of Salvador Allende's popular unity government and the coup of September 11th, 1973. Marian Schlatterbeck is author of Beyond the Vanguard, Everyday Revolutionaries in Allende's Chile.
Thank you. Allende vive Chile.
Gracias a Dios.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. De pie cantar que vamos a triunfar. Avanzan ya banderas de unidad y tú vendrás marchando.
And that's the great Chilean group Inti Illimani. They were lucky to be in Rome at the time of the coup and were not able to return until the end of the Pinochet regime. And before the music, we heard Laurie Mercier talking with Marian Schlatterbeck about the September 11th right-wing coup in Chile and about today's social movements there. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Here in the U.S., of course, the fascist neo-Nazi right has been emboldened by the campaign and election of Donald Trump and are taking to the streets to proclaim their white supremacy. Should the left take it upon themselves to fight their violence with violence of their own, hoping to stop fascism before it spreads, as the left failed to do in Germany in the 30s? Here are Bill Resnick and Greg McKelvey to discuss this and other questions.
Greg McKelvey, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Greg McKelvey grew up in Portland, just graduated from Lewis and Clark Law School, has been an activist in the Black Lives Matter struggle. After the Trump election, he co-founded Portland Resistance. So first, Greg, tell us why and how you built Portland Resistance and its activities, and then we can discuss some of the really difficult and profound issues we face today in dealing with Trumpism and with the emerging white nationalist or neo-Nazi right in Portland and around the country. First, Portland Resistance.
Sure. So we founded actually on the night of the election. There were protests that were already going to be happening. As soon as people found out who won, people took to the streets. And we wanted to continue those protests, and we wanted to make sure that people knew of a central location where those protests could meet. After about 1 or 2 days, what I really wanted to make sure was that this movement didn't just go away and that we were actually pushing for progressive change in our city to insulate ourselves from the policies of Donald Trump. Basically, we wanted to find a way to harness this anti-Trump energy, not just to resist the administration, but also to push our city forward, which is needed now more than ever under Donald Trump.
It seems to me you had several focuses at the beginning. One of them is Trump and the white nationalists that were emerging out of his shadow and getting very aggressive in Portland and other places. And then the responses became aggressive and sometimes counterproductive. And the second thing was the police, who you've been attempting to, quote, reform for quite a long time with Black Lives Matter and before, not terribly successfully, I'm afraid, although we can talk about that.
For sure.
And what you're doing now. Why don't we start with the alternative right? You've been a controversial figure, I think, in fighting the alternative right. You've called for direct action, but specific kinds of direct action. My sense was that it amounts to nonviolent direct action, but very muscular. And I think we should talk about those two kinds of direct action and your position and the resistance position on
it. So Portland's resistance is only ever going to call for peaceful action. We're entirely nonviolent, and we don't even, you know, use this language of self-defense that some people view as provocative, but rather we do want to make sure that we build a strong community and that we send a message to the most marginalized people in our community that we do not stand for these neo-Nazis or neo-fascists or white supremacists at all. So we're not calling for street brawls in the street. I would argue that maybe the alt-right sometimes does call for that. But rather, we call for sending a message to the most marginalized people within our communities that hate is not what we stand for. So we have kind of moved away from the counter protests, because I think that that movement on the right has kind of exposed itself for what it is in their inability or unwillingness to isolate the self-avowed white supremacists and the neo-Nazis within their group. They've completely lost any sort of support, I think, within the community. But it's these lone wolf type attacks like Jeremy Christian. The next Jeremy Christian is probably going to come from this same movement that we see rallying in Portland every once in a while. So we need to think about how we're not just going to defend ourselves, but how we're going to build a strong community and unite against that form of hate.
Yeah, there are also parts of the left, though, that really want to engage the neo-Nazis, alt-right. They want to engage them in street brawls and frighten them. And they call it, we're going to nip them in the bud. And they analogize the situation to Nazi Germany in the early years of Hitler's organizing and argue that if the left had just destroyed them on the streets, which in fact the left tried to do, it had a lot of militias. In fact, they were fighting on the streets all the time.
Yeah.
And the Nazis were in fact more ruthless, as well as supported by the police. Their analysis is wrong about what happened in Nazi Germany. But they do believe that the time is now to make them afraid, to beat them up, to make sure that no recruit that the recruits see them getting beaten up and don't see them as a rising physical force.
So I have tremendous respect for our Antifa movement here in Portland, as well as the anarchist community, who those anti-fascists, the
right.
people that who are willing to put themselves on the line to fight against fascism. However, I do think that if you're going to fight against fascism, we need to make sure that we are being strategic and tactical. And I think that right now, it is clear that if you want to just defeat the Trump movement, or you want to defeat the alt-right or white supremacy in general, that the anarchists or the Antifa movement does not have the numbers to do that right now. You're fighting against a large segment of society. And so what I would say is that who is closest to you that you could possibly unite with and stand against fascism, and that would be the progressives and the liberals and even the white moderates that we see here in Portland and across the country. So as you alienate those people and isolate yourself, you diminish your chances of actually standing against the fascists and the white supremacists. I think what they would argue is, yes, that there were people fighting Nazis in the streets during the rise of the Nazis and Hitler's regime, but what if everybody had united and fought in the streets? And so these people will talk down upon the people who are not in the streets fighting, like, why do you not care about this? You are the same as just a German who happened to not be a Jew who was doing fine until your country is completely destroyed and your values are gone. So I understand their ideology. I just think that we should be very strategic in this movement, and we should not make moves that might isolate ourselves and alienate those who could be potential allies.
It seems to me that your case is also really strong in that we do have the numbers. We outnumber them by 5, 8, 10 to 1, even in these rallies where a lot of people don't come because they're afraid of the of the violence. And one of the rallies that I was at, there were no children. No children at all. And that's because parents didn't want to bring their kids if they came, or many people just did not come because they were afraid of the violence. And then the police, of course, responding to the violence with their own violence.
Correct.
And provoking the violence often. And that's another problem we will talk about later in this interview. It seems to me that the violence diminishes our power because it alienates all these people, or it frightens our allies from coming. And it's often so dramatic, and the media focus on it, that the left becomes identified with violence.
Yeah. You know, I think it's important to realize that even a vast majority of the people who you see that might look scary, that are wearing masks at protests or all black, a majority of those people are not committing violence even.
Yeah, I know. And absolutely right.
Yeah. And I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying that there are people who believe that if you show up at a protest in a mask, that you were obviously there to commit violence or do something illegal, which is just untrue.
No, there are a lot of great organizing by anarchists in town.
Exactly. Yeah. And those are some people that have been the most dedicated to social justice in our community. And there are people behind those masks. And those are people that oftentimes will talk to you if you walk up without being afraid of them. But at the same time, I think that violence for the sake of violence is counterproductive. It might feel good in the moment because these are people that are incredibly marginalized oftentimes by the system that we are living under. But showing restraint and not committing violence for the sake of violence, I think, is ideal. I remember on May Day, we saw windows being broken out, and that can be counterproductive. What we also saw was some people super gluing the ATMs, major banks. That's a form of direct action that can actually hit the pockets of the people who you view are oppressing you. Let's say we break a window at Bank of America. It's not the Bank of America CEO that comes and cleans up that window. It's somebody that is a potential ally of yours who is probably making minimum wage, who comes up and cleans that window. And now they might not be aligned with you anymore because they're cutting their fingers on glass because you wanted to break a window. But if during the campaign we had even moderates and progressives and liberals alike all saying that Donald Trump was akin to Hitler or was a fascist and was horrible and was going to be the worst thing for the country, and I would argue that it's basically only anarchists and Antifa that are acting as if that was all true. So if you during the campaign were saying this guy is like Hitler and then he got elected and you're saying let's police other people's protests, then did you really ever believe that this guy was that bad? And so I'm not at a moment right now where I think we should go break windows or anything like that, but I can't blame somebody for saying that they are at that point, because let's say that Donald Trump is Hitler. Let's say that we are years into a Holocaust or something like that. Then does breaking windows become more strategic? So I'm not there yet. I don't think Donald Trump is there yet, but I'm not going to chastise somebody for deciding that they are there yet because they are using the same rhetoric that even the moderates used during the campaign.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole talking to Greg McKelvey, one of the co-founders of the Portland Resistance. We've been talking about responding to the fascist fascist, neo-fascist, alt-right organizing in Portland. We focused on the value of sort of brawls and violent confrontations with them. I think they're really counterproductive. Greg has pointed out that it's really counterproductive now. There might be a time when it's necessary to do that kind of self-defense. And you pointed out, Greg, that most of the people who manage their appearance to look semi-menacing and unidentifiable in black outfits, they're actually quite reasonable. A lot of them doing decent work, and some of them are critical of those who really just want to go in and attack. It seems to me that the thing to do is to try and transform them to some extent into a really robust self-defense force that is nonviolent themselves and not provoking the police, but in fact responding in ways that are nonviolent but powerful. It's possible to be nonviolent and very muscular and powerful. Anyway, that's my hypothesis.
Yeah, I think that that is where we are headed. And I think that there are many people that are working towards that. I would also argue that a lot of people that maybe are throwing things in the first place view it as a response in self-defense in general. So we have to kind of define our terms, and we need to have standards. And one of those standards needs to be you don't do things that throw all of your comrades into jeopardy. Because when you throw something, it's the most marginalized people who could be affected by that.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting. From the point of view of a lot of the people who are throwing things and wanting to fight back, they've been so badly treated in a lot of ways, and the police have been so arbitrary and attacking and trying to humiliate them that when they see these robocops and the rest of it massing, it's a sort of a response of trying to retain your dignity. It's hard to resist just wanting to somehow spit back at them.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're just walking down the street and you see one of these cops, you don't have the opportunity to throw a sandwich at them. But if you are shielded by an entire crowd, you feel that you might be able to. And so when I started protesting, in full disclosure, I do not identify as an anarchist. But when I first started protesting, I kind of thought that the anarchists were counterproductive to the entire movement. And I think that many people that maybe don't come to these protests view it that same way. But as you go to many, many protests and you see the same people getting beat up by the same cops for nothing over and over and over again, you start to realize why they might be so angry at the police and at the system in general. And then we can't have a city and a society in general that marginalizes these youth. Probably a majority of them identify as queer. And so many of them are marginalized in our society and looked down upon. And you can't build a society like that and then not expect a small portion of them to lash out. I think it's amazing that there are not more people throwing things when we have created a system that looks like how it does now.
Greg, let's talk about direct action and the police. It's very alarming what's happened to the police in the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you talk about that and how we can be muscular with regard to the police and force them to change their tactics? That is, they're just violating speech rights and assembly rights as a deliberate set of actions.
You would gather this very quickly from being at protest that these people that are dressed up in riot gear and in these warrior costumes are just completely anti-protester. But in my meetings with the city, with the mayor, with city commissioners, what I've realized is that the police really do believe that the left and the anarchist movement, as well as my movement and really any sort of resistance movement, is incredibly violent, dangerous, destructive, and a threat to order in our city. And I think that that's just a wrong analysis on their part. And so when they come dressed like this, they are dressing for war because they really view that that's what we are in right now, is a war between leftist protesters and the police. And instead, what they should be doing is coming in to facilitate people's First Amendment rights. Like, it doesn't make sense for them to line up in military gear against protesters when these protesters hold the same political values as the boss and the people who are supposed to be running the police department. This is the community. The community in general stands with the values of protesters, I believe. And so when you line up against them, you're doing a disservice to the entire city. Instead, what I argue is, why don't they march with them? Why don't they send 5 officers in a march and you march with them rather than being lined up against them? And if you see someone commit a crime, you target that one person. But it doesn't make sense now that if one person does something that the state has deemed illegal, we're going to crack down on an entire protest. There's not one of our other rights that work that way. Our Second Amendment right doesn't work that way. The police don't get to say, somebody committed a murder last night, so I'm going to kick down the door and pepper spray and tear gas and beat with batons everybody that peacefully exercises their Second Amendment right because somebody messed up last night. People would be up in arms, literally. But for some reason, for the First Amendment, our police department has taken the line that if one person commits a crime, we're taking away everybody's First Amendment rights. And I don't even want to equate the First and Second Amendment because the First Amendment is first for a reason. A lot more people have voices than guns. And the First Amendment and direct action and protesting, every single piece of progress that America has made, every single positive social change that we have made has come hand in hand with protest. We're a country founded upon protest. And there is nothing more American than using your First Amendment right to push for change and to push for progress. And I would argue that it is un-American to then go out and try and squash that. How we stop that is, okay, so we had in November 8th and 9th, Charlie Hales was still mayor, and he took, for the first time that I had seen, probably because he disagreed with the election of Donald Trump, a complete hands-off approach on the November 8th and November 9th, and really November 10th protests. And everything was fine. They marched around, disrupted traffic. I led many of those. And then on November 10th is when we saw that first riot where things were smashed. So after that, and leading even till the inauguration, the police response was, we're not going to let that happen again, because the community was really upset by seeing broken windows and the police not doing anything. But what we saw then is at the inauguration day, tons of people come out that are now not afraid anymore and come out and they get beat up. And they're like, wait, we're not rioters. Why did we get beat up? Then we see on May Day where people come out and they get beat up and they say, we weren't rioters. Why did we get beat up? We see on June 4th where there was a massive counter protest to the alt-right after the Jeremy Christian murder. People get beat up. So as Trump does things and the city does things that lead people to go out into the streets that maybe wouldn't have, and they finally see firsthand, wait, these people are not all bad. Most of these people were not doing anything wrong. I certainly wasn't doing anything wrong, and I still got beat up. That changes the public perception. There's only two ways that this ends, is that the police beat protests out of our city, or the people of Portland continue to protest and continue to withstand these attacks from the police and then stand up and say, this is not right. So what we need is we need the community, people that maybe can't make it to protest or don't go to protest, to act as if it is your son or your daughter that is the one getting beat up there. I don't throw things. I get beat up by the police every time that I go protest. What if I was your son, your daughter, your fiance, your husband, your wife? That is how we need to be responding to things. And I think what we have now is an opportunity under Donald Trump to continue to be given the fuel to go hit the streets. And as the Portland police continue to beat us up, the community will finally realize that, look, this is not right. These people are not all black bloc anarchists that are only out for destruction. These are the people of Portland that are going out and standing up for their rights, trying to get change, trying to resist this administration, trying to reform our police department, and they are getting beat up. That is not right. So what we need to make this change is for the community to stand with us and not stand with the police. And sometimes that takes firsthand experience of being at these protests.
It seems to me public support is crucial. Changing police is very difficult because their police union stands with every one of their officers, even the most violent. And there are some who really enjoy these protests because they want to get some action. It's a terrible trend. You're not going to stop that by street fighting. It's going to be stopped by a great public movement and ultimately very different leadership in this country that, yep, in fact, enforces other kinds of policies and gives people alternatives.
And if we protest and that's it, we don't vote, we don't engage in our political process, then it's all for nothing. And that's oftentimes where I disagree with many people in the anarchist movement. I've sat down with Ted Wheeler. I've sat down with his office. I've sat down with our city commissioners. And I believe that because we have the ability to put thousands of people on the street, that increases our leverage in negotiating and trying to reform our entire city. And I think that that is the power that protest has, and that is what we're aiming to do. But if we talk about public support, you can't do any of this without public support. But the thing is, the police have a 24/7 media operation where they can send press release. They know all the reporters, they people that are paid to work on their public relations team. We don't have that on our side. So we not only need the public to support us, but we also need our media to step up and be covering this. And we've seen great things from many people in the media, including KBOO. But what we haven't seen is our nightly news, our news channels, Channel 2, you know, 6, 8, 12, doing the hard journalistic work. And that's where many people engage with the stories of our city. And so we need them to step up and do real journalism and dig deep into these things. So we need the public to do their job and question the police, but we also need the media to do the same. And many publications are stepping up, but we need them all to.
Greg McKelvey, thanks so much for talking to us today. Keep up the good work in Portland Resistance.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
Forceful part of Schubert's Last Sonata, played by Alfred Brendel. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Greg McKelvey about fascist and anti-fascist demonstrators and the police here in Portland. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Continuing the theme of resistance to Trumpism, journalist Aaron Gupta followed the Trump campaign, and the Old Mole's Denise Morris has put together these comments from Gupta's appearance at an April event in Portland sponsored by the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA. Gupta breaks down Trump's base, white evangelicals, alt-right, and white nationalists. He concludes that while these groups are dangerous and can hurt people, it is ultimately the power of the state that can be mobilized to inflict widespread harm, particularly against immigrants and refugees.
Trump is a genius. He blew up the establishment of both parties. He's a genius at demagoguery, at manipulating the media, and stoking hatred and fear. And so he has a diehard base, and that's what he's going to rely on. So, but lost in all the sound and fury is the role of class. He's an authoritarian, he's a white nationalist and nativist, and his cabinet is thick with generals and oligarchs, but there's no militia party like the Nazi party. There's no eugenics program. There's no creation of the new man to bring into being a totalitarian ideology. Fascism is about a dynamic. It's not about like a checklist. And none of that is evident. It's also clear that Trump is ideologically promiscuous, and ultimately he's most concerned with his ego, his brand, and his wealth. So why does so much of the working class, especially whites and men, support him? I think it's actually pretty simple, and this is based on a lot of my reporting. He exploited the rage of the Great Recession and the Democrats' ploy to shift the Wall Street-made crisis onto the backs of workers. Race and class, the formation of these, are inseparable, and what he did was tied this white working class rage to Islamophobia, xenophobia, hatred of Latinos, fear of African Americans. And he wrapped it in male aggression, privilege, and resentment. So his campaign was not just white nationalist, it was patriarchal white nationalism. And that you see how for many working class women, that they see their social reproduction is best guaranteed through marriage. And this is social engineering by the right, right? So this explains why the fact that many white women decried his misogyny. Nonetheless, there were a majority of white women who voted for a muscular, aggressive assertion of white American male power at home and abroad. Now, the thing is, Trump is no fool. He taps into the gruesome side of American history by racializing class politics. He tells Americans, Mexicans are taking our jobs. China is dumping their goods here. Muslims and refugees are weakening us. And most of all, illegals are stealing our tax dollars and jobs, causing crime and poisoning us with drugs. And so his language is one of ethnic cleansing. And again, this is ethnic cleansing defines American history. America was made possible by Native American genocide and the chattel slavery of Africans. And then from there we see slave codes, anti-Catholic riots, and anti-Chinese pogroms in the 19th century, then the terror of the KKK, Jim Crow, anti-black massacres, particularly in the World War I era, the massacre of thousands of Chicanos in the Southwest. Many of these massacres were actually led by the Texas Rangers, Japanese internment, quote-unquote Operation Wetback in the 1950s, the mass expulsion of Mexicans and often U.S. citizens from the Southwest, and the forced relocation and cultural destructive of Native Americans. So we can see how it plays out at ground level. Last summer at a Trump rally in Everett, Washington, we met Chuck and Denise, a middle-aged couple from Tacoma, Washington. Chuck said they backed Trump because we're old-fashioned. We need law and order back. Trump says he's going to build the wall. The flies are coming in, the mosquitoes are coming in. That's a direct quote. Denise chimed in about Syrian refugees, which she said is a huge issue. It bothers me we are letting in 200,000 refugees. We have no idea what they're doing. They're probably affiliated with ISIS. They were raised to hate us. Chuck said we're opposed to Islam. When asked if they were Christian, they said yes, explaining they were non-denominational evangelicals. Chuck was worried about coming to the rally. We don't know about Black Lives Matter, if they would have guns. Denise complained about billboards we can't read. They said they welcome Hispanics in their neighborhoods, but, quote, don't try to twist it around and make it look like Mexico. We're the furthest thing from racist, but you end up looking like the biggest racist on the block. There's a few interesting thing about this. You know, obviously it's just two people, but nonetheless, a big one is the fact they're evangelicals. Liberals and the left continually discount the importance of right-wing evangelicals. They handed Trump the presidency. He won 81% of white Christian evangelicals. This was more than Bush won in 2004 when he was running as the evangelical president. They made up 26% of the electorate in the 2016 race. Meanwhile, people of color made up 29% of the electorate and Clinton won 74%. So when you do the math, in effect, white Christian evangelicals completely neutralized Clinton's advantage among all people of color. That should be pretty sobering. It also shows how right-wing evangelicals are more sophisticated than many on the left. The Christian right has a transactional relationship with Trump. They're willing to ignore his horrendous personal ethics for political gain. In contrast, many on the left took a puritanical approach to Clinton, puffing her up as an existential threat rather than considering how, despite her many noxious policies, they were one, not nearly as bad as Trump, and two, there was also far more political room for the left to push her to the left. So one more issue worth considering is the reason is Trump is so obsessed with the border wall and anti-immigrant policies is his base probably supports these positions, and he recognizes it. It's the notion of a white American republic is what binds his supporters to them. We also met at the rally Blake Von Mittman, self-identified proud nationalist and alt-righter. He said, I've never been a racist. I love all the races. Illegal immigration is a plague. One thing I take out of this, it's kind of like a Gramscian consensus. And so that's a notion that there's one class that is basically going to be the leading class, you know, for the bourgeoisie, that is, and all classes will benefit from the bourgeoisie rule. And what we see is a spectrum from evangelicals to alt-righters is that instead there's one race that will benefit all the races. And it's no matter how racist they are, in words and ideas, they deny being a racist. This explains, I think, why there is no mass outpouring of support for fascism. Now, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, neo-Confederates are dangerous, But there's still very much a fringe movement, right? The real danger is the state. And the danger could be seen from Trump's first week in office, where he intensified the repressive elements of immigration enforcement. First of all, the White House said we're going to unshackle ICE, and that's very much what they've done, then, so that they can now sweep up undocumented immigrants wherever they find them. And we can also see a certain level of duplicity, which is how Trump operates. They're very, at once, I think, both crude and sophisticated. So ICE claims its enforcement is routine, and he's also saying he's not targeting DACA recipients. These are those who get the deferred action for childhood arrivals. That's the Obama-era policy that provided protection to about 700,000 undocumented youth who came over as children. So they're on the one hand saying, oh, nothing's changing. And the problem is that there are clearly a lot of continuities with Obama immigration policy, but it's also there are some real differences. First 2.5 months of 2017, ICE immigration arrests had jumped 33%. Arrests of immigrants without a criminal record have more than doubled, right? And this is why I say the threat is the state. Certainly fascists can go out and kill people, they can hurt people, but it's this industrial scale apparatus, you know, where tens, hundreds of thousands, millions of people can be adversely affected. Already the Trump administration has identified 33,000 more beds for its detention apparatus. So they are cranking up this vast industrial scale machinery.
We just heard remarks by Arun Gupta about the Trump campaign in a piece produced by the Old Mole's Denise Morris here on KBOO's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and I have a commentary now about capital's abandonment of the working class. In the last few years, a number of polls have shown higher favorability ratings for socialism and lower ratings for capitalism, especially among the young. It's worth asking what there is in our times about the lived experience of capitalism that would lead people to lose faith in this arrangement of our lives. First, let's clarify what capitalism is. What is capital? It is that portion of our wealth that is not being used for immediate consumption, but which can be used to produce the goods and services we consume. In the system we call capitalism, capital is owned by private individuals and institutions such as banks, corporations, insurance companies, and mutual funds. The owners of capital put that wealth where it can earn the greatest return, whether that be into building apartment buildings and office complexes, into the production of food and clothing and electronics, or into stocks and bonds. They are under no obligation to invest their capital into projects that will benefit the public unless that's where the greatest return on their investment would be. F. Scott Fitzgerald once wrote, "Let me tell you about the very rich. They are different from you and me," unquote. Aside from the effect that being rich has on one's personality, a capitalist is different from you and me in not having to work for a living, but instead being able to determine whether and how the rest of us work and live. If capital finds it profitable to invest in production that requires workers, then some of us can work and live within the limits of our wages and our work schedule. If the capitalist finds he or she can do better by putting their capital into interest-bearing bank accounts or shares in Google or American Airlines, then that capital does nothing for you and me. Now, this is obviously a system of inequality and exploitation, though its cruelty has been somewhat mitigated by the state under pressure from the labor movement. But even though it is obviously unjust and undemocratic that so few, that is the very rich, should have the economic power to control the lives of the rest of us, we have been persuaded to go along with it for two reasons. First, we have been sold the fantasy that capitalists earn their capital by hard work and ingenuity, and that therefore anyone can grow up and become a capitalist. Now, it's not that this never happens, but it's almost as rare as winning the lottery, and most wealthy capitalists inherited their money and social position. The second and more important reason we put up with capitalism is our trust in a kind of bargain we are supposed to have with capital. in return for letting the owners have their riches and the enormous power that goes with them, capital will provide us with jobs, putting us to work, making the goods and services we want and need. This idea is invoked whenever the Republicans refer to capitalists as job creators, as they plead for further tax reductions for their wealthy supporters. We are supposed to believe that they will use the extra money they get from paying lower taxes to buy plants and equipment and raw material for us to work on in return for wages. Politicians justify cutting environmental and labor regulations on corporations on the premise that such regulations kill jobs. Another part of this implicit social contract with capital is that capital will, through taxation, help to support the infrastructure necessary to produce stuff with a large labor force, like education and transportation. Lately, however, capital has not been keeping its part of the bargain. According to economic historian Robert Brenner, the economy today is doing worse than at any time since the Great Depression. Gross national product has been in a long decline for several decades, and especially since 2008. Labor productivity, the amount each person is producing, has fallen every decade since 1973. Why? Because capital has not been investing. But wait, the stock market is at an all-time high, and the rich are far richer than ever. The top 1% is now getting about 25% of the national income, while before 1980, the richest 1% got only 8 to 10% of it. So how in the world are those at the top doing so well if the economy is doing so badly and those with capital are not putting their money to work? The simple answer is theft. The just mentioned date of 1980 should ring a bell. That's when Ronald Reagan was elected, and politicians led by Republicans, with Democrats soon to follow, began to implement the policies we now call neoliberalism. It began with a massive shift of the tax burden from corporations and the highest tax brackets to the rest of us, together with an assault on wages and the unions that kept wages up. Financial deregulation followed, enabling people with lots of money to invest in elaborate financial schemes that drove up the stock market and the paper value of real estate. Then, when the bubble burst in 2008, the government of the corporate state bailed out the bankers and financiers, leaving them whole and the rest of us to our own devices. This many-pronged scheme for stealing from the poor and giving to the rich, which is the essence of neoliberalism, also includes turning over resources that used to belong to all of us to the rich through privatization. Thus, education, water, policing, military work, and incarceration, among others, have been taken away from the public and turned into the private property of corporations run in the financial interests of their stockholders. Politicians and corporate spokespeople still talk as if every break given to the rich will enable them to create more jobs, but it's a lie. Every new dollar they get goes into money-making schemes like hedge funds that have nothing to do with real production or creating jobs. The contract between capital and the working class is a dead letter. Capital has no further interest in the viability of the working class, and that's why they don't mind a healthcare system that will let millions more die. The mass of the working class is surplus population and can be allowed to sink into illness, drug addiction, opioid oblivion, and death, while the rich live in their gated enclaves guarded by private security forces. It's time to give up the fantasy that what's good for capital is good for all of us. Capitalism is a toxic system that can maintain itself only by subterfuge and force. It can no longer meet the terms of our bargain with it, bad as that was. It's time to organize with the goal of taking back the wealth that has been stolen from us and to conceive and build a world that is organized not for the advantage of a few, but for the benefit of all of us. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And that concludes today's Old Mole Variety Hour. If you'd like to hear any or all of today's show again or recommend it to your friends, go to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show will be up in a day or two. Many thanks to Lori Mercier and Marion Schlotterbeck for their discussion of the events of 9/11 of 1973 in Chile, to Bill Resnick and Greg McKelvey for their inquiry into how to confront fascistic demonstrators in Portland, and to Denise Morris for putting together the comments of Arun Gupta about the Trump campaign and Trump supporters, and to Patsy Kullberg for her expert engineering of the show. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Join us again next Monday morning for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. KBOO keeps you informed and you have a chance to get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
If I'm a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.